have a huge effect on the way someone like you lives? After a brief silence, I opened my mouth.
Who do you think you are? You don't know anything about me.
The bell chimed the end of lunch hour. Miyamoto clicked his tongue and rose to his feet.
Just when it was getting interesting.
I'll be back. You can give me an answer then. I went home, thinking about everything Miyamoto said. No one seemed to be there. My mother had entered her third week away from the house. I peeked into the living room and found a putter lying on the floor and golf balls scattered everywhere. I picked up the putter and leaned it against the sofa. Night came, and my father still hadn't come home. Just as I was thinking about what to order for dinner, my father called on the phone. He was really drunk.
Hey, are you studying or what?
Have you been drinking?
Yep.
That's not like you.
I quit drinking the day you were born, so it's been 18 years.
What is it? Did something good happen?
The opposite.
What happened?
I'll tell you about it later. Right now, I need you to bring me some cash.
Huh?
I ran out of money, and I can't pay the bill.
You're killing me.
Sorry.
I got an address and hung up the phone. I changed my clothes, took out the rest of the condolence money from the desk drawer, and put it in my pocket. I left the house, locking the door behind me. The rain, which had been coming down since morning, had finally let up. My father stood slumped against the wall next to the main street exit of Ueno Station. He looked like he might slide down the wall and crumple on the ground any second. Next to him stood an unhappy-looking young man. I went through the ticket barrier and up to my father. I patted his shoulder. His body twitched as he opened his eyes.
Oh, my dutiful son, he said,
a wide smile spreading across his face. His breath blew into my face, reeking of alcohol.
Would you pay this man his money, please?
My father pointed at the young man. I asked him how much and paid him.
Maybe you should tell your father to carry a credit card, said the young man sarcastically.
Quite a few years back, my father applied for a credit card and was rejected on the background check. At the time, he had money to burn. The reason for the rejection was obvious. He was Korean. Ever since then, my father had a thing against credit cards. Annoyed, I thought of pushing the guy around a little, but my father, perhaps sensing my irritation, pushed the young man's back and said to have a good night, as if to send him on his way. The young man clicked his tongue and moved off.
"Can you walk?" I asked. "Sure I can," my father slurred as he walked off toward the ticket machines.
He dragged his feet like an actor playing drunk in a comedy sketch. His pants were muddy around the waist. I fell in line next to him and held him by the waist.
"Let's get a taxi," I suggested.
My father put his arm around my shoulder and asked if I had enough money. I nodded. As I helped my father walk slowly toward the taxi stand, he muttered,
"I took two phone calls back-to-back today. The first one was that I was losing another one of my prize exchange booths. The other was an international call from North Korea to tell me that Tong-il died."
I stopped walking. Tong-il was my uncle who had moved to North Korea.
"How did he die?" I asked.
"Some kind of illness. The call was from his wife. She said something about high blood pressure or malnutrition. I couldn't make out what she was trying to say, so I'm not sure what the direct cause was. We were on the phone for about half an hour, and she spent about 25 minutes blaming me, about how I lived such a good life but never sent my younger brother anything."
"You sent him plenty," I said in a firm tone.
"Guess it wasn't enough."
My father urged me forward, saying,
"Let's go."
So I started walking again. We got in a taxi and told the elderly driver the destination. The taxi got caught in traffic and moved at a snail's pace, maybe because it was the end of the month and a weekend night. For a while, my father and I were quiet, sitting buried in our seats. My father looked out the front windshield in a daze. Meanwhile, I thought about the uncle that I'd never met. How long would it take to go from Japan to North Korea by plane? 2 hours? Three? I could spend roughly the same number of hours and actually arrive in South Korea, but not North Korea. How did that come to be? In the first place, both Koreas are nothing more than pieces of land. What was prohibiting me from going to North Korea? The deep ocean? The tall mountains? The big sky? It was humans. The sons of bitches that put themselves there and roped off the territory as their own were the ones keeping me from seeing my uncle. Can you believe it? Everyone's always talking about how the technology boom has brought the world closer, but I still can't go to a place that's only hours away. I will never forgive the arrogant sons of bitches in North Korea. Ever. The taxi cleared the traffic and began to cruise at a good speed.
Tong-il was good at drawing, my father suddenly began. Soon after the war, the family moved from Osaka to Okayama near a fishing port. We didn't stay very long, so I can't exactly remember where. Instead of school, I went to the port every day and did simple chores like unloading the cages filled with the day's catch from the fishing boats and cleaning the boats to get some food to eat for dinner. Since Aboji and Omoni found good work in Yamaguchi, I was in charge of looking after Tong-il. Every day, Tong-il passed the time on the embankment drawing pictures with charcoal until I got done working. I was so worried that he might fall into the sea from the embankment. Tong-il could get so absorbed when he was drawing. One day, the port union boss took a look at Tong-il's drawings and had Tong-il paint a picture on the bow of his fishing boat. It was a picture of a sun rising up over the sea. It was well drawn, and the union boss seemed happy with it. 3 days later, the boss's boat encountered a storm at sea. When it got dark and the boat still hadn't returned, everyone gave the boat and crew up for lost. But then the boat returned the next morning. Since that incident, rumors spread that Tong-il's picture was a good luck charm, and suddenly, people wanted Tong-il to paint something on their boats. Fishermen can be a superstitious lot. Tong-il quickly became a popular painter, and soon, he was the one looking after me. Once, he brought home a whole crab, something even I hadn't done. I was so proud of him. That was the first time I ever ate crab. Tong-il, too. As embarrassing as this may sound, we cried while we ate, saying again and again how good it tasted. I wonder if he ever ate crab up north. Maybe I should have sent him some crab.
It was a good story. My father's eyes had welled up with tears. I guess the ideal scenario would have been for me to put my arm around him and say, cheer up, and for my father to become overcome with emotion and hug me. Not a chance. This old man has worked me over my entire life. In the spring of my second year in junior high school, I stole a moped and got caught, naturally without a license, and with two others riding with me to boot. Because I'd been caught doing all sorts of bad things in the past, this time it was entirely possible that I wouldn't get off with a misdemeanor, but would be sent to family court. My father came to the station and said, "I'm sorry for what my son has done," and pleaded for a misdemeanor charge. The instant he saw me, the old man drilled a hard right hook to my temple. Already half unconscious, I was hit in the liver with a left body hook, which was quickly followed by another left hook in the face. In boxing, this was called a double left hook. Because of the body hook, I started vomiting. Because of the left hook, I broke a molar. The tooth came out of my mouth along with stomach fluid. My father grabbed me as I was vomiting on the floor, pulled me up by the collar, and landed a right straight squarely on my chin. I don't exactly remember what happened after that. Only the voice of the interrogating detective screaming, "Please, forgive him! He's going to die!" was echoing inside my head. When I came to, I was lying in the back seat of my father's car. Somehow, I managed to sit up and found my father beaming at me in the rear-view mirror.
"You got off with no strikes on your record," he said, chuckling. "Be grateful."
That's when I swore to myself, someday, I'm going to kill this son of a bitch with my own hands. Anyway, so much for the ideal scenario for my father and me. Besides, until I gave my father the sound beating he deserved, he wasn't going to be brought to his knees by anything, no matter what. Regardless of whether his business was taken away by the state or whether his beloved younger brother died, he wasn't going to show weakness. The only thing that was going to knock this man down, a man who'd never gone down in a fight ever, was me. And so I said,
"Will you stop with the crab? Jeez, you sound pathetic.
The days when people are going to cry over your sorry sob story are over. It's because you, first and second generation Zainichi, are so piss poor that my generation can't shine." With tears still in his eyes, my father looked at me, shocked. I continued, "If the people up north want to eat crab, then start a freaking revolution. What the hell are they doing up there?" The tears began to recede from my father's eyes. I said, "Your brother must have resented you. While he was struggling, you were off in Hawaii playing golf. I bet he's going to show up at your pillow tonight as a ghost. Aloha!" A stench of alcohol so thick you could grab it came wafting from my father's entire body. His pores must have opened. His face was a different shade of red than before. I decided to finish him off. "You know what? Your days are over. Your sad, pathetic days are finished." An aura of alcohol and murder emanated from my father's body. As he opened his mouth to say something, the taxi, which had been cruising along, suddenly screeched its brakes and stopped on the side of the road. After putting the car in park, the elderly taxi driver turned around. His face was crimson.
"How dare you talk to your father like that?" he shouted at me.
I guess I was universally incompatible with taxi drivers. My father said,
"Looks like you got touched in the head from all that studying." I answered, "Shut up, you punch drunk."
My father took a deep breath and said to the taxi driver,
"Please, wait here. We're going to settle this outside."
My father and I got out of the taxi and scanned the area. There was a park entrance up at the other end of the sidewalk. Silently, we started walking that way. The taxi driver followed behind us. The park was big. The circular space where we entered was surrounded by benches. On the benches sat several young couples, flirting with each other. My father and I went to the center of the circle and faced each other about 2 yards apart. A halogen light shined like a spotlight on both of us. The taxi driver stood a bit off-center between us like a referee. For an instant, my mother's face came to mind. My mother would say to me, "If you ever lay a hand on your father, I'm going to kill you and then kill myself." It was the last sentiment of Confucian spirit my mother still had inside her. But no way was I going to back down now, no matter what. I steeled myself. I took a breath so my father wouldn't notice and held it in my belly. My father opened his mouth and said in a mocking tone,
"Come, Luke."
"Shut up." After bending my knees into a near squat, I kicked off from the balls of my feet and dove inside his reach. Although the human eye can easily pick up lateral movements, it's difficult to react to vertical movements. The average person would panic at the sight of me attacking from below and be KO'd with one punch, defenseless. But my father, a former nationally ranked boxer, was different. He instinctively brought his arms together in front of his face like a shield. In a split second, I changed my line of attack from the face to my father's body. My left hook landed squarely on his liver. The average person would reflexively lower his guard to protect his body and take a second left hook in the face. My father didn't lower his guard. I tested him again and delivered a right hook to his ribs. He let out a groan but kept his arms hard against his face. Around the time my father first started teaching me to box, he often would say this, "Don't let yourself get knocked down by a body blow. You'll never be an elite boxer. You've got to harden up the body. Take as many punches in the body as you can and sap your opponent of his power. But make sure you guard your head. Even if your body gets beat up, as long as you have your head, you have a chance. Always." I kept pounding him in the body so as not to give him an opening to counterattack. But God, he was hard. Really hard. It was hard to believe this was the body of a man who would turn 60 in a couple of years. Who the hell did he think he was? What did you have to eat to get a body like this? I was getting impatient. I sidestepped his guard and began punching the side of his face. Aiming for the right part under the ear, I unleashed a steady series of hooks right and left. A good hit there could numb the semicircular canal, causing the opponent to lose his sense of balance, making it easier to knock him down. I got a couple of good hits in, and my father's knees gradually grew wobbly. His arms, which were held up against his face, slowly began to separate to the sides to protect his ears. If I kept attacking below the ears, his arms would separate even more, leaving his face wide open, and I'd be able to punch him in the nose. Then I'd win. I'd make my father's knees touch the mat for the first time. I continued to pound him with my hook, silently willing his arms to open. Open! His arms split apart about 4 inches, and I sighted my father's nose and mouth. His nose was where it usually was, but his lips... He had curled his lower lip inside his mouth and was biting down on it with his front teeth. He didn't seem to be doing it to bear the pain. Suddenly, his mouth started making a chur-chur sound, like he was sucking something. The old man was biting his lip and sucking something at the same time. When I got wise to his trick, it was too late. Suddenly, my father let down his guard. The instant his eyes shone, reflecting the halogen light, the blood came spraying out of his mouth. Because I'd been mesmerized by the light in his eyes, I closed my eyes too late. A fight is always decided in an instant. The blood flew into my eyes and blinded me. I took 3 punches to the face. Boom, boom, boom. The first punch hit me like a hunk of concrete and made my spine creak. I felt the second punch break one of my front teeth. I locked my guard in front of my face. I took a heavy punch in the ribs, right and left. I let down my guard, then a hook under the left ear. For an instant, a pale flame floated up and disappeared before my closed eyes. In the next instant, I collapsed. I lay down, putting my back flat on the ground. The earth was teetering unsteadily. I was going to be sick. Someone stopped the earth from tilting. My father's voice came down from above. The earth stopped.
What idiot lets down his guard?
After spitting out the blood pooled in my mouth, somehow I managed to squeeze out the words,
"That was dirty."
My father's stern voice pelted my body.
"Sorry, but this is how we've managed to scrap out a win. I can't change my ways now."
I rubbed my eyes to try to see in the direction of the voice, but I couldn't quite wipe the blood, my father's blood, out of my eyes. Still, I looked in the direction the voice was coming from. Maybe it was because I was looking up at him, but my father looked huge in my eyes. The taxi driver went to him, grabbed his right arm, and raised it above his head. The bystanders around us broke into applause. There were even a few whistles. Amid congratulations from the taxi driver and the couples, my father smiled, embarrassed. My eyes hurt, so I closed them. The tears came naturally. Blinking several times, I squeezed out the blood mixed with tears from my eyes. The applause and cheers did not stop.
"Damn it. Damn it. Damn it."
After I washed off the blood at the water fountain, I got in the taxi again. I stared at the broken tooth in the palm of my hand. As I was cleaning off my face at the fountain, the taxi driver had come and given it to me. I traced what was left of my front tooth with my tongue. A pain shot through my head every time I breathed through my mouth. Maybe the nerve was exposed. I opened the window halfway and tossed the broken tooth outside. My father muttered,
"You may be right about something."
"About what?" I asked.
"That my generation's time has passed."
I looked at my father's profile. The bruise on his chin was beginning to turn from red to blue. There were teeth marks etched clearly on his lower lip, dotted with lots of tiny scab spots.
"This country is gradually beginning to change, and will continue to change. Zainichi or Japanese. Pretty soon, that's not going to matter anymore. That's why your generation should set your sights outward."
"Really?" I asked in earnest. "Do you really think this country will change?" Whatever his reasoning might have been, he gave me a sure nod. A confident smile was spread across his face.
Reasoning?
There wasn't any reasoning required. What was important was to believe. Definitely.
"Is everything going to be okay at work?"
"Yeah,"
he said spiritedly.
"I still have one booth. I never planned to stay in this business for very long or have you take it over, so if I finish with zero in the end, I'll be all right with that. Your mother and I already have enough saved up to enjoy retirement. But you're on your own."
My father let out a hearty laugh. He never got past elementary school, yet taught himself to read Marx and Nietzsche. With his concrete body and a mind as sharp as ice, he's continued to fight and survive in this tough country. Deep down, I knew why this bastard had suddenly changed his citizenship to South Korean.
He didn't do it so he could go to Hawaii. He did it for me.
He was trying to unburden me from one of the shackles chained to my legs. I knew why this beautiful bastard had decorated the foyer with that embarrassing picture of him being kissed on the cheek as he was flashing a peace sign. It was because he knew that by turning his back on Chongryong and Mindan, he would lose most of his friends and acquaintances. No one in this country was going to give this crazy old guy his due for continuing to fight all on his own. That's why I decided to tell him. "I'll erase these national borders someday." After staring at me in amazement at these words, my father flashed an invincible smile and said,
"You should know our family hails from a long line of bullshit artists dating back to the Joseon dynasty."
My father and I looked at each other and laughed. The taxi stopped at a light back near our neighborhood. From outside the rolled-down window of the taxi came the unseasonal sound of a summer wind bell in the distance. Chirring, 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 chirring. My father let slip a cherubic smile and said,
"The sound brings back memories."
I didn't know whether there was a custom of hanging wind bells in Korea. I'm pretty sure my father didn't know either. We arrived in front of our house. The taxi driver refused to take my father's money.
"You've shown me something far more special. Please, use the money to send your brother some flowers."
The light was on in the house. This wasn't good. I steeled myself and went inside. My mother came to the door and took one look at us, and her face changed color in an instant. She ran past my father and me and disappeared out the door. 10 seconds later, she came back with a bamboo broom in her hands. She beat me with the butt end of the broom 38 times. My father stood there watching and said,
"Now that'll teach you the power of love," and let out a belly laugh.
My mother beat him 3 times. I became so bruised and feverish that I stayed home from school for 3 days. Lunch break. An uncomfortable air filled the classroom. When I'd opened my mouth and answered the teacher's question during second period Japanese class, everyone found out my front tooth was chipped. Challengers were likely to come gunning for me today. The classroom door rattled open. Everyone's eyes flew in that direction. With a disappointed sigh, they went back to talking to their friends. Miyamoto turned the chair around and sat down in front of me, like before. "So, did you give it some thought?" he asked.
"You can keep me out of it," I answered.
Miyamoto let out a short sigh and said, "If you don't mind, would you at least tell me why, so I can take notes for next time?" After I thought about it, I answered,
"It's got nothing to do with what you're trying to do. I think it's right, and it's important. I'm trying to accomplish the same thing, but in my own way."
Miyamoto smiled cynically. "I figured you for a realist." I let out a scornful laugh.
"I am a realist. I've got my eye on something different, that's all."
Miyamoto, with the same cynical smile on his face, said, "Go ahead. Try to do it on your own if you can. Careful that this country doesn't squash you first." I stared quietly at Miyamoto's face for a while, then said,
"Look, I don't have any beef with you. Like I said, what you're trying to do is right. I just can't be a part of it, that's all. I'm busy."
The look of cynicism vanished from Miyamoto's face.
"Busy? With what?"
"There's someone I have to beat. To beat him, I need to study and get myself stronger. There isn't any going forward until I defeat him, but when I do, I'll be all but invincible. I can even change the world."
My fight record since I started high school now sat at 25-1. I was no longer the undefeated king. That one loss was a huge one. Miyamoto shook his head like he had no clue what I was talking about. I said,
"The reason I don't change my nationality is because I don't want to be incorporated or assimilated or strapped down by any country. I'm tired of living, feeling like I'm a part of some big system, and that includes your little group."
Miyamoto opened his mouth to say something, but I cut him off.
"But if Kim Basinger ever asked me to change my nationality, I'd go down and fill out the forms right now. That's all that nationality is to me. But maybe that just makes me a hypocrite."
Miyamoto, who'd been staring at me with a stern look and his mouth half open, loosened up and smiled.
"Now if you're talking Catherine Deneuve..."
"What are you, 100?
"Shut up."
We gave each other a look and laughed, just as the door at the front of the classroom flew open. I told Miyamoto, "You should get out of the way." Miyamoto got up from the chair and stuck his hand out at me. We exchanged a firm handshake. I shifted my gaze from Miyamoto retreating to safety in the corner to the challenger coming at me. I thought about what one-liner I should go with today. Maybe that thing my father said would do the trick.
"No soy coreano, ni japonés. Soy un nomada desarraigado."
I'm not Korean or Japanese. I'm a rootless vagabond. Yeah, that's what I'll say. 7. The gloomy, rainy days of November gave way to December. I continued to put in some serious time studying for the entrance exams, while my mother put in some serious time at the driving school, and my father put in some serious time on the golf course. One Sunday in the beginning of December, I went to Jung-il's house to return all the stuff he'd lent me.
"I wish you'd hold on to them for Jung-il," his mother said, smiling. "What happened to your tooth?"
She said that after some soul-searching, she decided to scatter Jung-il's ashes in different countries.
"I'm planning to go to South Korea for the first time, soon."
When I offered to tag along as her interpreter, she said,
"I'm desperately trying to learn Korean right now," and laughed cheerfully. "Such fun learning a language I don't know. I should have started sooner, when he was still alive."
When I was ready to leave,
Jong-il's mother walked me to the door and said, "Please, keep Jong-il in your memories." I answered, "Yes, always." Sometime in the middle of December, my mother told me Naomi-san was getting married. The guy was an American businessman working at a foreign company who came around the restaurant a lot. Taking a break between cram sessions, I went to the restaurant to congratulate her. When I did, Naomi-san smiled happily and said, "It's like the descendants of the two groups that went their own way somewhere in the Middle East all those years ago found each other in Japan. Isn't it wonderful?" I nodded emphatically. "Your chipped tooth is very cute," she said, giving my cheek a gentle stroke. "You have to get cuter and get yourself a nice girl and be happier than everyone else. All right?" I nodded and teased. "You're using more English in your speech, Naomi-san." For some reason, Naomi-san's cheeks became flushed as she gave me a seductive smile. On the evening of December 23rd, I accidentally bumped into Wonsu on the train platform at Ikebukuro Station. I was on the Yamanote Line platform on my way to cram school, while Wonsu stood on the Saikyo Line platform on the opposite side. We spotted each other almost at the same time. He was there with three of his buddies. They noticed me too. For a while, we stood facing each other with the four rails sandwiched between us. Then a train pulled into Wonsu's side of the platform first, blocking them from view. Then a train pulled into my side of the platform soon after. I didn't get on the train. The trains departed, clearing my view. Wonsu and his buddies were gone. I moved to the middle of the platform where there was more room and waited. My fight record against Wonsu was 3-2, so I was one up on him. After about a minute, Wonsu appeared. None of his buddies were with him. I stood where I was and waited for Wonsu to approach me. He stopped opposite me. He cast a piercing look, a deep line creasing his brow. It was a look I'd seen a million times. He wasn't the least bit intimidating. I couldn't help but flash a smile. A bemused expression came over his face for an instant at the sight of my tooth, but the severe look returned.
"Who did that to you?"
That was Wonsu. Anytime one of his own got hurt or disrespected, he didn't think twice. He was the first one out for revenge. "It was my old man." When I said this, his grim look faded. I flashed another smile at Wonsu, and he smiled, a bit bashfully. Wonsu stepped to the side, so we were standing shoulder to shoulder. We now faced the platform where Wonsu had been only moments ago. After another train came and went, Wonsu, keeping his eyes trained straight ahead, said,
"Do you remember the time we stole that moped and got caught riding it 3 deep?
I kept looking straight ahead and nodded. Wonsu said,
"I'll never forget the way your aboji came into the police station and beat the living daylights out of you. I was so freaked he was going to beat me next that I thought about playing dead."
"What do you think, my old man's a bear?"
"Not any ordinary bear, a grizzly."
We laughed, our eyes still looking straight ahead. Wonsu muttered,
"Your aboji is cool."
Wonsu's father had a habit of saying,
"If I were born Japanese, I would have been prime minister or president of a company."
Whenever he had a bad day at the factory, he got drunk and hit Wonsu. Wonsu had burn scars on his left shoulder blade, the right side of his belly button, right butt cheek, left thigh, and the top of his right foot, where his aboji had pressed a lit mosquito coil into him. Wonsu ended up running away from home 5 times, and I went along with him every time. The first time was in the 3rd grade, when we got on the Tokaido line from Tokyo Station and went to Chigasaki. The next time, we ran away to Odawara, then Atami, and Shizuoka after that, running farther away every time until finally we reached Nagoya and became pachinko kings. Running away was fun.
which made having to go back home and parting ways all the more difficult, and we resorted to trash-talking each other about how the other had stupid-looking eyebrows, or how one couldn't stand the way the other ate with his chopsticks, or some such nonsense, and got into a knockdown fight. Thus, my 3-2 record against him. We went our separate ways, vowing never to go anywhere with each other again, and we were back to hanging out the next day like nothing had ever happened. I adored Wonsu. Two trains came and went. Wonsu spoke.
You said at the funeral that I never talked to Jong-il. You're wrong about that. Actually, I did talk to him. We never talked about anything serious like you guys did. He talked about you a lot.
I turned toward him. He was still looking straight ahead. I looked forward again. Two more trains came and went. Countless passengers went past us. Wonsu and I stood absolutely still on the platform. Wonsu said,
Look, I know what's up. I know that the North and Chongryong are only thinking about using us and can't be counted on. But I plan on making a go here on the inside. Believe it or not, I do have some guys depending on me. So long as I can fight for them, I won't have to be a screw-up.
Yeah, I know. Two more trains. Wonsu asked,
What do you talk about in that Japanese school of yours?
I don't really talk to anyone.
Do you have any friends?
Nah.
Oh?
Two more trains. Wonsu said,
If we live long enough to become tired old geezers, we should go to the hot springs together.
Nah, farther than that. We should go to Hawaii.
Hawaii? That sounds great.
Two more trains. Wonsu said, That day you did the test of courage?
You are pretty cool.
Yeah. Another train. Wonsu said,
Go. Get on the train already.
Yeah. Another train. Wonsu said,
Go. I let you off today for that hit at the funeral.
Shut up. I'll go when I want. Another train. Wonsu said,
Go, unless you want to get decked. I can't stand the way you live your life.
I felt his eyes on me. I turned toward him. Wonsu was looking at me, smiling like he was about to cry.
Tell me, Wonsu, what does my face look like now? I can't tell.
Another train was coming. After taking a step forward, I managed to squeeze out the words.
Don't get yourself killed.
Still smiling back his tears, Wonsu jerked his chin up defiantly, the same chin that must have repelled dozens of my punches, and said,
They're not going to kill me so easily.
The train slid into the platform and came to a stop. I casually raised a hand and said,
See ya,
and walked forward. I felt Wonsu's old, familiar gaze on my back. I boarded the train. Even after the doors shut behind me, I could still feel his gaze on me. I didn't turn around until the train had completely pulled out of the station. Christmas Eve. I'd been holed up in my room, studying for the entrance exam since morning, when my father poked his head in and gave a sinister laugh.
Quiet.
After he closed the door, I could hear him singing. The old man must have learned lyrics to that Tatsuro Yamashita song about spending Christmas Eve alone just so he could throw dirt in my face. Jackass. At night, the phone rang. My father shouted, Phone! From below. My father and mother never answered the phone when they were playing chess. Reluctantly, I put down my pencil and picked up the cordless in my room. It was Sakurai.
I haven't seen you for ages, she said. I hesitated. How have you been? She asked. I kept quiet. Sakurai continued anyway. I'm doing great. After a brief silence, Sakurai seemed to finally work up the courage. You remember the elementary school, don't you? Can you meet me there now? I'll wait for you. She hung up the phone. I switched off the phone and laid down on the bed. I thought about this and that for about 5 minutes, but my decision was obvious from the start. I got up and started to change. I put on a white long-sleeve shirt and jeans and got into a black down jacket. I took out what little was left of the condolence money from the desk drawer and stuffed it into my jeans pocket. I'm going out for a while. My mother and father looked up from the chess pieces on the board at the same time. My mother said, Didn't I tell you to cap that tooth? Telling my mother to be quiet, I went out into the foyer. As I put on my shoes, I could hear my father doing his best rendition of Bing Crosby. Silent night, holy night. All is calm, all is bright. I thought you were a Marxist, for Christ's sake. I left the house. It took me an hour and a half to arrive in front of the iron gate of the elementary school. I jumped over the gate and went inside the grounds. I looked around the schoolyard. Sakurai's white figure sitting on the bench next to the bronze bust of some famous person stood out in the darkness. Slowly I walked toward her. She was wearing a white duffel coat over a blue turtleneck sweater. She looked great. Her hair, which had grown, was parted on the left and pulled back behind her ears. Her intelligent forehead was showing. I adored Sakurai's forehead. I stopped and stood in front of Sakurai. Her face was clouded with nervousness. I looked down at her, saying nothing. She smiled awkwardly and said, Thanks for coming. I kept silent. I've been looking up at the sky, waiting for you. Every time the moon disappeared behind the clouds, I was worried that it might start snowing. The forecast said that it was supposed to rain or snow today. Snow on Christmas Eve. Isn't that just horrible? Meeting a boy like this on a snowy Christmas Eve. I just die of embarrassment. Unless, of course, I don't die from the cold first. Sakurai let out a big sigh. Her white breath floated up and disappeared. The smile vanished from her face, and she said, I've been thinking about a lot of things since we stopped seeing each other, and I've read a lot of books, a lot of difficult books, and... I squatted down in front of her. It must have been sudden as a tiny gasp escaped Sakurai's mouth. Her face was rigid with nerves. Looking up and giving her a hard look, I said, Who am I? What? Who am I? After thinking about it for a moment, Sakurai answered, You're Zainichi. I turned around and after giving the pedestal of the bronze statue 3 good kicks, I faced Sakurai again and said, I swear, sometimes I want to just kill all you Japanese. How can you call us Zainichi without so much as a second thought? We were born in this country and raised in this country. Don't call us that like we're the same as the American military or Iranians that just stepped off the boat yesterday. Calling us Zainichi is the same as saying we're foreigners who'll eventually leave the country. Do you get that? Have you ever taken the time to think about that? Even once? Sakurai swallowed and kept looking at me. I knelt down before her. Who cares? If you people want to call me Zainichi, go ahead. You Japanese are scared of me. Can't feel safe unless you categorize and label it, right? But you're wrong. You know what? I'm a lion. A lion has no idea he's a lion. It's just a random name that you people gave him so you can feel like you know all about him. See what happens when you try to get closer, calling my name. I'll pounce on your carotid artery and tear you to shreds. You understand? As long as you call me Zainichi, you're always going to be my victim. I'm not Zainichi, or South Korean, or North Korean, or Mongoloid. Quit forcing me into those narrow categories. I'm me. Wait, I don't even want to be me anymore. I want to be free from having to be me. I'll go anywhere to find whatever thing will let me forget who I am. And if that thing isn't here, I'll get out of this country, which is what you wanted anyway. You can't do that, can you? No, you'll all die, tied down by your ideas about country, land, titles, customs, tradition, and culture. Well, that's too bad. I never had any of that stuff, so I'm free to go anywhere I please. Jealous? Say you're jealous. Damn it. What am I saying? Damn it! Damn it!
Sakurai's hands reached out and found my cheeks. Her hands felt warm.
Those eyes,
she said, her voice trembling as she smiled faintly.
Eyes?
She nodded, smiling some more, and continued.
Last September, I got a horrible grade on my mock exams, and even though I knew how stupid it was to get all depressed about it, I was feeling depressed anyway. It was a rainy day after school, and I was thinking how I didn't want to go home just yet when I went by the gym and there was a basketball game going on. I don't know anything about basketball, and I'm not the least bit interested, but for some reason, on that day, I was drawn to the sound of the basketball hitting the court, so I just wandered in. At first, I was kind of watching the game, but soon I couldn't take my eyes off one of the boys in the game. His movements were so graceful, like he was performing a choreographed dance. I just kept watching him, wishing that I could move like that. Suddenly, the boy threw the basketball at the face of the boy guarding him. The other boy must have given him a nasty foul or said something terrible to him. It happened so suddenly I was in shock. The court went quiet for a second, and then one kid on the same team as the boy who'd been hit charged the boy who threw the basketball. Then the boy jumped up in the air really high and drop-kicked the kid charging at him. I'd only seen pro wrestlers on TV drop-kick anyone, so I got really excited seeing it live. And if that wasn't enough, the boy drop-kicked every one of the boys charging him, one after the next. The time he was in the air must have been longer than the time on solid ground. I was so mesmerized by this boy's movements. The way he moved was so incredible. It was as if gravity didn't exist around him at all. Like he'd changed the laws of nature. And just like that, all the players on the opposing team were on the floor with their noses bleeding and stuff. The refs finally came over to try to restrain the boy, but he was so worked up that he started drop-kicking the refs. By this point, everything was so ridiculous that I was laughing and laughing. Then the boy's coach turned to the players on the bench and said, "Somebody, stop Sugihara, go!" In my heart, I was screaming for you to run away, but it was no use. The moment you landed after drop-kicking a second ref, your teammates grabbed you. But you still fought back, shouting, "Let me go! Let me go!" Your teammates seemed reluctant, but after they managed to get you on the ground somehow, they piled on top of you. There were about four of them, I think, making like this mound on top of you. I was so devastated you'd been caught that I was stupidly almost in tears. But the tears stopped right away. The mound was heaving up and down, up and down, even with four people piled on top of you. I just lost it and burst out laughing, rolling on the seats until my sides hurt. I was laughing so hard that the tears started coming again. When I finally got a hold of myself and looked down, some of your senpai were smacking you across the face, and then your coach grabbed you by the back of the uniform and dragged you off the court to the locker room. It was hilarious. I mean, you looked like a naughty kitten being picked up by the scruff of the neck, about to be tossed outside. You and the coach walked over toward where I was sitting. I leaned out of my seat to follow you with my eyes. That's when you glared at me with these really intense eyes. I had you all wrong. You weren't a kitten, but a lion. And when you glared at me, I got shivers up and down my spine and felt weird inside. And then I realized I was wet. It was the first time that happened to me. I never got that way when I was kissed or touched by a boy before, but just you glaring at me got me wet. For a long time, I waited for you outside the school, but I guess you left from the back, so I couldn't meet you then. From that day, I had your name and the name of your high school stamped in my brain. A couple of times, I thought about going to your high school, but I couldn't work up the courage because I'd never done something like that before. And then I talked to my friends about it. They warned me, saying, "Don't get involved with anyone that goes to that stupid school." And they even said, "You'll get raped if you go anywhere near that school." So, in the end, I couldn't bring myself to go. But I always knew that I was going to meet you someday. I was sure of it. So in April, when a boy who sits next to me in class showed me the ticket to a party he'd been forced to buy, and I saw the party was being organized by someone from your school and heard that lots of boys from the school were going to be there, I asked for the boy's ticket because I knew I had to go. And when I went to the party, there you were, just like I'd known you'd be. I recognized you right away. Because you glared at me then, too. And then I got wet again. Cupping my cheeks, Sakurai's hands seemed to tense. I'm really excited right now. Do you want to feel? Here? I said, a bit off guard. Sakurai nodded. I wavered for a moment and answered, "Maybe this isn't the place." Suddenly, Sakurai drew my face into her chest. With her hands on the back of my head and neck, she held me tight. Badum, badum. I could hear the sound of her heart beating. That familiar sound. That comforting sound. Sakurai's voice came from above. "I don't care what you are, Sugihara. As long as you jump for me and look at me with those eyes once in a while, I don't care if you don't speak Japanese. There isn't anyone, anywhere, who can jump and look at me like you do." "Really?" I asked, my face still buried in her chest. "Yes. I know that now. Actually, I might have known it since the first time I saw you." Sakurai kissed the top of my head 3 times. Her arms relaxed around me, so I slowly raised my head from her chest. Sakurai looked at me and said, "Why are you crying?" "No way," I said. "I can't cry when other people are around." Sakurai narrowed her eyes as though she were looking at something bright, put her palms against my cheeks again, and wiped the tears on my face with her thumbs. "I've been dying to tell you," she said, putting on a serious face. "That chipped tooth makes you look adorable." We looked at each other and laughed. Letting go of my face, Sakurai stood up. "The moon's about to hide behind the clouds again. Let's go somewhere before it begins to snow and ruins everything."
"Where do you want to go?"
"Anywhere. Somewhere warm first. We can think about where we're going to stay tonight."
"Are you sure?"
"Let's work on not asking such tiresome questions." Sakurai moved past me and began skipping toward the main gate. Still kneeling on the ground, I chased after her with my eyes. Sakurai stopped and turned around. The most beautiful smile I'd ever seen spread across her face. Out of her mouth came a breath as white as snow and a warm voice. "Let's go."
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Go by Kazuki Kaneshiro, translated by Takami Niada, performed by Brian Nishi. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.